Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money, KPCW's program about business, personal finance, real estate, investing, anything to do with making money, holding on to it, making it grow. This is Pam Wiley with my co-host, Larry Warren.
Good morning. And I'm going to be distracted this whole hour because I'm looking out our corner studio suite upon the ski slopes with fresh snow. The sun's just come out. Where was this storm in November? And December,
and January, and February, and early March. Well, it was waiting for now, and it's absolutely gorgeous. Everybody come on up and ski. It is just, or snowboard. It is just absolutely
This is the primo day to be out there powder skiing, that's for sure. But we are talking money and all things to do with finance, personal investing, and so on. And our first guest, we're pleased to have Gretchen Morgenson with us. She's a Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times columnist who will be talking about her book, Reckless Endangerment, about the causes of the 2008 financial meltdown. And she'll be coming to Sundance this weekend as part of the Authors Series. So this is a preview of what you can hear in person if you care to sign up.
Yes, and I'll be listening today, too, and I'll be at Sundance as well this Saturday. So, yes, looking forward to that.
And we have with us on the line now Gretchen Morgenson, and she is a columnist with the New York Times, has won the Pulitzer Prize for what's called her trenchant and incisive coverage of Wall Street. She's also worked in her prior life as a stockbroker at Dean Witter, and then became a reporter at Forbes, Worth, and Money Magazines. The book is Reckless Endangerment, How Outsized Ambition, Greed, and Corruption Led to Economic Armageddon. Welcome, Gretchen.
Thank you so much, Larry. I hope it sounds like you have a beautiful day out there. I'm heading your way, so keep that good weather coming.
Well, pack your skis, because of all the resorts, Sundance got the most snow.
Really? Fantastic.
And sometimes they get shortchanged in these storms, but it came from the south this time, and it just slammed Sundance. So you'll be in good shape.
Wow, that's fantastic.
But let's talk about something more dismal.
Oh, do we have to?
Okay, the book is all about the mortgage crisis, and it's really puts between two covers everything that happened from the beginning, the dawn of time of the mortgage crisis. It's interesting that it began with the noble premise that all Americans should be able to live in their own home rather than be transient renters all their lives.
Right.
That's kind of the crux of all that came to pass, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's interesting because even to this day, after all that we've been through and the economic crisis and the recession and, you know, the failure of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are costing taxpayers now $180 billion, even now we're still not able to have an honest dialogue in Washington about, you know, what role, if any, the government should play in housing. And so I think what's really been very amazing and fascinating to me is how you can go through something this devastating for so many people, millions of people losing their jobs, losing their homes, and still not really, you know, be able to talk openly about this. You know, if the government should subsidize housing, and if it does, how should it do it? I think that couldn't be more important as a topic of discussion, but we just aren't hearing it at all.
Well, along with that, though, is we haven't had an honest dialogue about banking either.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, this was a travesty that was created over a long period of time, as you noted, Larry. We go back in the book to 1991 as kind of the pivotal moment when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac really started the engines revving. And then Wall Street, of course, took over from them and took the mortgage mania to the max. And then we had the aftermath, which we're still crawling out thought of, honestly. This is one of the longest-running financial crises that I think we can remember really within certainly the last generation. So, yes, we have not had the discussion that we need to about the role that banks played in the mess and how to make sure that they will not do it again.
But central to the mess and one of the focal points, or the focal point of your book, is Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And I think to this day there's confusion over these two agencies. They began as federal agencies, but they've morphed into or intentionally became something else. And those two really seem to be at the heart of all that happened.
Well, they really were leading the way. You know, as I said a minute ago, Wall Street, by all means, was in there with both hands, and, you know, they were very, very involved in driving the mania, particularly, you know, at the end of sort of the 2000s. But Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were there in the beginning, and they sort of led the way in automating the underwriting of loans, speeding the process of lending. Now, they're not lenders per se. As you know, what they do is they guarantee mortgages or they buy mortgages that have been written by a bank and they hold them in their portfolios. So what their job really is to provide financing so that mortgages continue to be made. And while they were doing that, these companies were enriching themselves and their executives really on the taxpayer's dime, because everyone understood that the companies would never be allowed to fail if they got into trouble, that the government would always step in and protect them from failure, which is, of course, what happened. And so that gave the companies a much smaller borrowing cost in the capital markets, and that was very lucrative for them. So these were profit-oriented companies that also had a call on the government, and that is kind of the worst combination that you can imagine.
So if we were to start talking about the accounting, that gets a little bit beyond most people's grasp. But if we said, okay, here you have this black box, and this black box is basically worth $7 billion a year, and they made it so that $5 billion of it went to the taxpayers, and they kept the other $2 billion. Would that be a good way of saying it?
The interesting thing was that for years and years, Pam, the companies would never tell anyone what the value of their subsidy was from the government. They had a lot of government perquisites. They had a line of credit with the Treasury. They didn't have to file their financial statements with the SEC. They didn't have to pay state and local taxes. You know, so but what was the value of these subsidies? The most valuable one, of course, was the fact that they did not have to pay market rates for borrowing money from investors. And so, but the companies wanted to keep secret what the value of the subsidy was, because they knew that people would object to it. It's a transfer of wealth, essentially, to these companies. And so what happened was a very interesting event occurred when the Congressional Budget Office actually sat down to try to figure out the value of the subsidy, and they came up with this $7 billion number, and that was back in the mid-90s. And they concluded that instead of passing it all on to homeowners, to borrowers, as the companies had always claimed that they did, the executives of the companies kept fully one-third of the value of the subsidy for themselves.
Wow.
Yeah. And they used that one-third to basically buy off Congress, didn't they?
Correct. To lobby, to put out these grassroots organizations across the country that, Congress people could go and have their photo ops with the ribbon-cutting ceremony for a new, project that Fannie Mae was financing. They also kept a lot of it for themselves in executive compensation, and they also, paid their shareholders dividends. So it was a variety of funding, that they deployed, but it was all about protecting that subsidy and making sure that it never went away.
And it borrowed from Jack Abramoff's playbook in that congressional aides were offered jobs on the payroll, and actually one Utah politician, Senator Bob Bennett's, one of his children or maybe more, were actually hired by Fannie to work in the company, and that buys a lot of friendships on the Hill, too.
You bet. I mean, this was a really very astute and shrewd organization, and they understood that if someone came along and said, look, we should just let these companies be private, like Citibank or Chase or J.P. Morgan, we should not have this quasi-government element involved, which puts the taxpayers at risk of a bailout. Whenever anyone came along and sort of piped up with that kind of a line of reasoning, the companies would just steamroller them. And so they had a lot of supporters in Congress that really they could use to deploy whenever they had any criticism arising about their practices. And that was unfortunate because what it did was it again made the dialogue very one-sided. There was never a kind of, really good conversation about, well, should these companies be able to extract so much money from the government subsidy and keep it for themselves? It was never discussed because they just made sure that they shut down any criticism.
Okay, we'd better step forward because we only have 10 or 12 minutes left, Gretchen. But and then the banks came along and repackaged vast numbers of mortgages into
junk packages
and sold them off as securities. How did the banks benefit from that?
Well, this was another really smart approach, because what happened was they were able to sell these loans to investors and have essentially plausible deniability about if they were bad or if the loans were starting to default. What they did was they just piled loans into these securities, made it very difficult to understand them, to see that they would never allow investors to really get down in and understand what each loan was and where it was. I mean, they would just talk very generally about what the loans were and their characteristics. But they were able to offload just billions of dollars worth of questionable loans to investors, and really with earning tremendous fees to do so and having very little risk associated with it. It was just an amazing role as middleman and very lucrative, just incredibly lucrative. So that was really one of the worst aspects of this episode.
To do that, the salesman for the banks had to just ignore ethics and what's right for the customer. They were, in fact, unloading bad loans in the bank's portfolios to the customers.
In fact, many of them knew that the loans were bad. Now, some of the customers were obviously clamoring for these kinds of securities because, remember, interest rates were very, very low, and it was very difficult for pension funds, insurance companies to, generate any income on their investments when rates were so low. So they were reaching for yield, as a common problem that gets a lot of people into trouble. And so they were eager for these securities, but they thought that they were, well put together. They thought the loans were money good, that they would pay out. But in many cases, we now know that the Wall Street firms that were selling the packages knew that the loans were already defaulting even before they were sold.
And so And one of the things you state is that the rating agencies changed their rating structures. They used to be that the investors were the ones who paid for the ratings, and then it became that the people being rated paid for the ratings.
Well, the ratings agencies certainly were central to this disaster, and that's one of the more frustrating aspects that we have now, even so, what 4 years after the real height of the problems, we still have not seen any kind of change in the ratings agency's business model. They continue to be relied upon. They continue to operate in the same way. It's one of the more really discouraging aspects of this.
This is, I guess, as a layman, what's maddening is, didn't anybody see any of the things they were doing, from rating agencies to banks to their salesmen to their customers, see this as an unethical business model?
Well, you know, that is the question. That's the $64 trillion question. And so it's very difficult to answer that broadly for everyone. I would love to know the answer, but clearly people were seeing dollar signs and very, very lucrative amounts of money to be made cutting corners. And not only did we see that in the years leading up to the crisis, but now, of course, I'm sure you've heard about all the corners that were cut in the foreclosure part of the crisis. So it really has been an epic failure to do the right thing almost every step along this assembly line. And I think that, the result is that Americans have lost a lot of trust for the institutions, I think, that they used to feel they could rely upon.
Well, yeah, I'm looking at it, and you've got Congress, that's business as usual. Lobbying, that's business as usual. The financial institutions, we interviewed a senator last week? And
Warren
he came
Hatch.
Down yeah. to on both sides of Dodd-Frank at the same time. You know, I said, what's been done to straighten this out? And he said, oh, we did Dodd-Frank. And then he came down about how bad it was.
Mm-hmm.
And then the ratings agencies, what about the regulators? Are the regulators stepping up to the plate?
Well, you know, that was a huge failure, of course, because they should have been policing these practices. They should have been reining in these companies, and they didn't. It really was almost that they were in the same mindset as the banks and the entities that they were charged with regulating. You know, now they are writing the rules that they must do under Dodd-Frank. They're subject to immense lobbying yet again, as they always are. So, you know, there's no real belief that regulators have gotten the message about what went wrong in the crisis. Certainly the Federal Reserve Board does not really seem to have consumers' interests at heart and policing this kind of these kinds of practices. So, yeah, that's another area where very little has changed, unfortunately.
And here's another area, which is the people who created this mess seem to have made the most from it and continue to make the most from it, and they end up with promotions. I mean, Hank Paulson is at Goldman Sachs, creates these products, and then he becomes Treasury Secretary. And it goes, the list like that goes on and on of people who profited from this. They're not going to jail. They're not having their profits confiscated. I mean, it just seems like they thumbed their nose at the entire country here, created chaos and unemployment and everything else, and come out smelling like roses.
Yeah, you know, there is one conclusion that you draw from this, unfortunately, and that is that there is no penalty for failure in Washington and or on Wall Street. Now, you know, obviously some of these executives lost a good bit of money when their stocks went to zero, but the other stakeholders were hurt far more: employees, innocent stockholders, et cetera. So it's really a bad sign when there is no penalty for failure.
All right, let's talk about what I think is perhaps the crux of the problem. What's the path of least resistance for someone in Congress? Is it to go home, which is 50 to 4,000 miles away, and go to endless fundraising dinners telling your constituents that you're fighting for them in the halls of Congress? Or do you just pocket the fat campaign contribution from a lobbyist, meaning you don't have to take time off for those flights home and those chicken dinners, and for that you take the lobbyist's bill that he or she has helpfully written for you, and you hope like heck that it won't mess things up in the future?
Well, I think that the path of least resistance is probably the second description that you just reeled off, unfortunately. You know, it's far easier. I mean, honestly, the number of issues that these people have to deal with and understand are really many. And so, you know, it's very difficult to expect them to be in depth and understand both sides of an issue, a very complex issue, you know, when they're dealing with, you know, 15, 20 issues that they have to be on top of. So they do rely, unfortunately, on lobbyists to educate them about these issues. And that is, I think, the beginning of the problem because, of course, the average taxpayer, you and me, we don't have a voice in Washington. We don't have a lobbyist. We don't have someone who's in there, you know, pushing for our needs and protecting us as all of these other large institutions do. And that's an imbalance that I think is very, very pernicious.
Okay, so after this worst meltdown in 70 years, is it just going to is there any meaningful reform? Is anything going to change?
Well, I have always said that Dodd-Frank had an opportunity to fix some of these things, but some of the largest problems it really did nothing about. First of all, it did nothing to resolve Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. We are into them for $183 billion. Number two, it did not eliminate too-big-to-fail institutions, which is the greatest threat to the taxpayer. I think, if anything, we've learned from this episode that the government will walk in and rescue large and politically interconnected institutions if they should get into trouble again. And we really should send the opposite message because that is just privatizing gains and socializing losses, and it's not the way capitalism is supposed to work.
Okay, well, it's not a very cheery picture you paint, but it's reality. So we will leave it at that. And Gretchen, you're going to be speaking at Sundance this Saturday, the 24th. Lunch is at noon with your lecture, Q&A, and book signing. And this is part of the Sundance Tree Room Authors Series. And you can find the tickets at sundanceresort.com. And bring your skis and your sunblock.
Well, I am so excited. I can't wait to see it. I've never been to Sundance. I'm a big Utah fan, but Snow Basin is usually my destination.
Well, you're a discerning skier. It's fabulous there as well. But
okay. Well, thanks, you guys. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks so much,
Gretchen. Appreciate you, Gretchen, for joining us.